reasserting the lie. At every moment, at every time in which the nation faces a kind of moral reckoning, there's a reassertion of the lie, and that lie is the belief that America is the shining city on the hill. That lie is the belief that Black folk don't really have the capacity to really take on the real serious burdens of citizenship. That lie is rooted, Amy, in this idea that racial justice is a philanthropic enterprise, right? And so what we're seeing in this moment is not only the energies of everyday ordinary people, we see clearly Donald Trump trying to reassert the lie that America is a white nation in the vein of old Europe.
Princeton University professor Eddie Glaude, his new book is Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. That does it for our broadcast. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. and it's time for more talk radio with your host, Cecil Prescott. Take it away.
Hey, great. Thank you so much. Good morning. And those of you who are listening live, today is Monday, the 27th day of July in the year 2020, and you are listening to KBOO FM 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany, and via the World Wide Web, it's kboo.fm. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I am your host this morning, the person who will hopefully guide you and welcome you into this living room of our minds as we explore what is happening in our world today. Our numbers, if you for you to call and participate, are 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187, and give us a call and share your thoughts as I speak. Today is Monday, the 27th of July. And we are in yet another phase of our occupation, goes in the city of Portland by federal troops. And listening to the Democracy Now! Program this morning, it occurred to me when they with the conversation about John Lewis and how after being beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in March 1965, and after they managed to get back to the Brown Chapel Church, Mr. Lewis, then a 25-year-old organizer, wondered why the President of the United States was unable to protect those who were walking, who were marching to the state capitol in Alabama to assert, to affirm, to plead for their rights to vote, and how the President of the United States was unable to protect them by sending federal troops to guard and protect people. I thought this was such a contrast to what those what we are seeing in the city of Portland, where federal troops have been sent to the city of Portland explicitly not to protect people, but to protect property. A contrast not just a contrast in terms of priorities. This president of the United States is seeking to protect buildings and glass and things such as that, while the federal troops are beating and hurting and arresting people. I think he says something about the priorities of a so-called real estate developer as president of the United States, that the priority over and over again are buildings and not people. Those are some of my thoughts as I listen to the Democracy Now! Program. And as we reflect on the life and legacy of John Lewis, and this week he has and will be memorialized in three places that he had an impact, in Alabama, in his hometown of Troy, and in Washington, D.C. I think it's important to remember his legacy and what that means for all of us. So as we reflect and as we breathe and as we try to find where we are, I wonder and ask for your participation and your thoughts about where are we at this particular moment in history. Those who have been, and I think we all have been impacted in the last 2 months since George Floyd killing, and that people have organized in their respective communities. Where are we in terms of things we should do? Now, we all have heard and have been considering the different tactics that people use, and the pleas of asking people to do this or not to do that. And this reminds me similarly to the debates that happened 60 years ago that John Lewis lived through and participated in terms of tactics and which role should one take. In the 1960s, for us, as we read and review the history, and things are not so nice and neat as we lay them out. History isn't, it's messy. But as we reviewed history and the movement for the rights of black people in the 1960s and the organizing that was done in communities throughout the cities, not only in the South, but in many communities throughout the nation. What we discovered and what we learned is that there were a diversity of opinions on the road to take. I'm always reminded how the diversity of opinion for me became crystal clear as you saw, and I think the program this morning, Democracy Now!, touched a little bit about that, of the debate which was going on within the civil rights movement in terms of debate of tactics and debate of ways in which people might participate. Clearly, that was shown in the not generational debates that people such as John Lewis participated in, but also in terms of ideological debate. A way in which it is understood today is that you had a generation of older mainstream organizers, as symbolized by the SCLC, which was an organization of predominantly black clergy and churches who sought to make transformative change in their communities. And lest we forget about the risk that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference took. I'm going back to the 1950s. We recall on the Montgomery bus campaign and the risk they took in terms of organizing a city and organizing people and communities to resist the government and to persist in insisting that the buses be integrated at certain risk for a campaign that lasted well over a year. They were able to organize communities, to organize alternative transportation methods, and by their organizing and by their insisting, they were able a year later for the city and authorities to agree to their demands. So lest we too easily paint the SCLC as some moderating forces, we also need to recognize that they, not only in the mid-50s, but throughout the 60s, continue to agitate for social and transformation. On the other hand, what you had developed at that period were younger organizers, those who were not as tied in to the established organizations, and you have the development of a group of mostly students, college students, who develop into the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that became known by the acronym of SNCC. And again, lest we make too clear of distinctions between the two, we see that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was an organizer of mostly students in colleges and university. At that time, black students in black colleges and universities in the South, because they were not allowed to go to white universities. But they organized, and part of their organizing was done in terms around of tactics. How shall we confront segregation, and how should we seek to abolish this evil institution? Again, the link between two generations were people such as Jim Lawson, who is a Methodist minister who trained hundreds and hundreds of students, of young people, in the tactics of nonviolent organizing. People such as John Lewis and thousands of others were trained in the tactics of nonviolence and organizing. So you had a younger cadre of organizers who were anxious and wanted change, who sometimes clashed with their elders in terms of wanting transformation now. And we saw that clearly leading up to the famous March on Washington in 1963, where you had a campaign of organizing and who should be involved. And again, if you look at the main organizations involved in leading up to the civil rights, to March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, lest we forget the name of it, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. So again, you had not a separation between goals. It was for economic and political reform, for jobs and freedom. But the main organizers were mainstream, and this is again looking at things that were a little bit different than they are now. When I say mainstream, the main organizations in black communities So you had organizations such as the NAACP, the Urban League, and SCLC, and you had what we had, it has been, is now known as the Big Six organizations and the Big Six people. Only one of them was a woman, but all of them, Big Six, were heads and chairs of civil rights organizations. And one of the Big Six was John Lewis, who was at the time of the March on Washington was 23. He was the head of that time of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I think it's interesting, if you often look at pictures of those people at that time, John Lewis is a younger, smaller man, oftentimes pushed to the back of pictures of organizers. And if you look at pictures when they met with the president at that time, JFK, John Kennedy, you see all these older middle-aged men, and off to the background you saw a young John Lewis. But at the time of the March on Washington, and we see the possible division of tactics and of perspectives in terms of who should speak and how should they speak. And John Lewis, at that time the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, wanted to deliver a fiery speech. For again, they had been marching and in communities throughout the South, organizing in communities throughout the South, and seeing communities being literally beaten down and attacked by police, by the communities, at people. Younger people were getting upset. So John Lewis and SNCC wanted to deliver a fiery speech at the March on Washington. And what we discovered were that as the civil rights movement developed, it was a very disciplined campaign. Things went a certain way. There was certain language. There was a certain protocol that people followed. So when people reviewed the speech that John Lewis wanted to make at campaign, people wanted to say it was too fiery. They wanted to edit his speech, and you can see compare the original speech that he crafted and the speech that they allowed him to speak at the March on Washington. So even there you saw a possible diversion of tactics and perspectives. And so I think it's important to always remember, as we come into the modern era today, that even in the so-called glory days, there were divisions and different perspectives on how things should happen.
Speaking of perspective, Cecil, we have a call. Mm-hmm. I believe Jason is on the line.
Okay, great. Well, let's speak to Jason and hear their perspective. Good morning, Jason.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the call. I actually just had a quick comment about the federal government's lack of response to the coronavirus. From my information, I was basically told that the administration had gotten information as early as November from the Pentagon intelligence indicating this could be a threat to our national security, and that we actually shared this information with other countries, including Israel. And if you look at some of the death rates and cases, especially in Israel, with a country of nearly 10 million people, they have under 500 deaths. And I was just wondering if you could make a comment on that about our lack of response and, you know, basically the administration denying its own military intelligence. Thank you. Yeah, I'll take the comments off the air. Thanks.
Oh, okay. Well, I wish you would have stayed on. But, yeah, I think that's a very important observation in terms of looking at the administration's response to the coronavirus and the information they had early on. And as you reminded us, Jason, that the lack of response is glaring in terms of the administration, as certainly as we compare it to other nations and how they responded to the virus. It is striking to see the lack of federal response and coordination here in the United States as we compare it to a disciplined plan of action that other nations embarked upon. Interestingly enough, this administration has denied the responsibility of the federal government in terms of coordinating a response, in terms of making sure that there are testings, that there equipment is there for all states and all communities, that medical professionals have what they need, and they have allowed states to go alone. Interesting, I think, that in response to the uprising around Black Lives Matter, that the federal government suddenly think that they have to come and clamp down on Black Lives Matters, and rather than taking that approach on the coronavirus and striking against the virus and coordinating a federal response. I think it says something about the priorities, and I wonder and I hope as people vote in November that they will take that contradiction or different priorities into account as they decide whether or not to affirm or deny the administration another term. So thank you, Jason, for bringing that that perspective up. And I think it's helpful to remind all of us as we think of, as I was talking about the uprising in our nations today, I think that's helpful to contrast the response of the nation's federal government to the coronavirus and the lack of response and the president response to the uprising of people for human rights in our nations. You are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil, and our numbers here are 503-231-8187. I'd like to know your thoughts and your perspectives, and how are you doing in terms of your where do we go from here? Certainly as the nation has focused around the uprising around Black Lives Matter protests in Portland and downtown Portland, and the continuing debate is not only one of tactics but whether or not there is a division not only in tactics but in terms of messaging. As I was sharing earlier and comparing this moment we are living in to the movement for civil rights 60 years ago, and contrasting making observations about the variety of roles and perspectives that John Lewis lived through. Just to close that discussion about the March on Washington and the variety of tactics. And what we saw in the civil rights movement was a division of tactics and maybe perspective, sometimes seen as a difference of generation, but it's more than that. You know, you have people on all sides, regardless of age, in terms of perspectives. And I think people are saying, and I've often said this moment, that, you know, when you have this debate over tactics and are people being too militant or not militant enough, are they being too accommodating or not, people have said, and I have said, well, you need a Malcolm and a Martin. You need a variety of perspective and ways it ways in which you might pressure the system to break down. And those divisions are not always easy. And I think it's helpful to remember that in the Selma campaign that we remember these days as we think about John Lewis and the campaign for voting rights in 1965, that the Selma campaign, that Malcolm was in the city and was unable to meet with Martin Luther King, but did meet with some other people in terms of John Lewis. So although you might have a public division between Malcolm and Martin, that privately, at least those who were working for the full inclusion of Black citizens into human and civil rights, they were able to sometimes behind closed doors at least meet and to have a conversation.
Speaking and so of having I wonder, a conversation, Cecil.
Mm-hmm.
We got a couple of folks who are looking to join this conversation. I believe John is up first.
Okay. Well, John, welcome to this conversation. Good morning.
Good morning, Cecil. I always like your show when I have a chance to listen. I wanted to repeat something I said on another show one time and then quote from a couple of teachers from India and then give the listeners a website to look at real quick.
Okay.
What I said previously one time is that maybe we already hit the iceberg as a nation, using the Titanic analogy, when we invaded this country and took up slavery and then never really owned up to that stuff. So we hit the iceberg, and as a nation we're sinking because we waited too long to own up to what we've done. That's one thing I wanted to say. And then I was going to quote a couple of teachers from India. One was Yogananda, who came in 1920 and was accused and had to appear in court, accused by jealous husbands whose wives were attending his meditation classes, and he actually lost in court. And that's how courts have been corrupt for a long time. So he wasn't molesting wives. He lost unjustly in court, and he almost left the country. And his response was, this nation's spiritual ignorance will be its undoing. So he was predicting doom for this nation. Then the other Indian teacher I want to quote is Krishnamurti. He said that you can't reform a nation because this system will resist it. You have to each reform yourself or revolutionize yourself, and then when enough of you are changed, you can, you know, enough of you become like John Lewis or Martin Luther King. You know, isn't it kind of telling that our most reformed or revolutionized people are not white people in this country? I'm a white guy, but I'm impressed by certain authors like Walt Whitman. He was also trying to save the nation with his Leaves of Grass. That I found out that years later, after knowing about Leaves of Grass and reading it, that was his goal, to save the nation, because he knew how messed up it was. Anyway, that was just a little touch on Walt Whitman.
Right.
The last thing I was going to leave you with is a website. I Googled the question, do any Christians think Trump is the Antichrist? And I found an author in his exploration of biblical prophecies about the Antichrist. Blew him away, and it blew me away. So the guy's name is Benjamin L. Corey, Corey.com. That's his website. His article is called Could American Evangelicals Spot the Antichrist? Here are the biblical predictions. And he goes through, like, I didn't count them, but there's like about 30 different scriptures that he refers to, way more than I had ever realized was out there. So Trump fits the bill so perfectly, you wouldn't believe it.
So
we have the Antichrist in the White House, in my opinion. I'm not a I'm not a conventional Christian. I'm a guy who discovered, like, almost 30 years ago that a text was found in a Tibetan monastery. It was there, but a Russian explorer broke his leg near this monastery, and he stayed there for 5 years. They helped his leg heal up, and then they weren't going to just hand him a sacred text, but he ended up walking away with a French translation, and it was first published in English in 1909. Well, I've told roughly, let's say, somewhere between 200 and 300 Christians over the years that this text exists.
What's the name of the text?
Guess how many have shown any interest? Zero.
Well, I don't. One or two, or a small number, I'm sure.
No, zero. Zero. Zero interest.
Zero. Okay. Hey, I want to go back. You named the first person you named, the first person you named.
Yogananda.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to make sure we had that. And the second person you also named, the Indian
Krishnamurti
teacher.
He's more. He was more recent than Yogananda. And I don't think he may have visited the West, but he mostly stayed in India. But yeah, both of them were non-sectarian. Yogananda settled in Los Angeles, and he had the Church of All Religions was the name of his church in Hollywood. So yeah,
well,
he's
thank
actually
you.
The most famous spiritual teacher in history, because his autobiography is the most well-read autobiography ever of any, which is kind of strange, but
yeah.
He had
I want to thank you so much for calling and for allowing us to know about these people, and also about Benjamin Corey. Thank you so much, John, for your thoughts and for sharing this morning. And you're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO 90.7. I'm Cecil Prescott. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. And do we have another call?
I believe we have Cassandra on the line.
Okay. Good morning, Cassandra.
Good morning, Cecil. Let's see. Where do I want to start? Basically, I completely agree with you that the priorities of this government that we are looking at is that of property over people. So much so that they obviously messed up on the coronavirus. They are disregarding the Black Lives Matter because it's lives, not black property matters. So lives are less important to them. I also, after listening to Democracy Now! This morning, hearing Tom Cotton, their wonder boy for the future, which I believe the Republicans are pinning their hopes on, who made the comment that slavery had been a necessary evil on which this country was built.
when that kind of unapologetic white supremacist attitude is in play, what can we expect? And this is the white attitude that we need to get rid of.
And how, I missed that segment of Democracy Now! This morning, but I'm not surprised. And, you know, in some sense, it sounds correct, because without slavery, this nation wouldn't be where it is today.
No, it wouldn't have. But the idea that the building of property on the bodies of any people is more important, that is the systemic problem we face in this country. It has been focused on black people, but once black people, by I'm sure sorry, I am anti-Republican. Well, I'm pretty much anti-government at this point in this country. But once they have gotten rid of, in their little playbooks, the black lives, they will then focus that same mentality onto yet another group, and yet another group, and another group. These sharks feed on, well, actually, they're more like piranhas. They'll just feed on whatever is thrown into the water, whatever's the most obvious to them, they hit first, but they just keep feeding. And it's that hatred and that just blind, I think it's panic. I think it's a sense of an inability to live in the moment. They're so worried about protecting their profits and their future wealth and what have you, that they cannot see what is important here and now, which are lives, people, interactions between people. So I think that is what drives these people, and it is definitely a fear, a panic, and an inability to see what priorities should be put first.
You know, you said something earlier that I think is helpful, because you said in terms of putting property over people. And it occurred to me that, you know, certainly slavery, you know, black people were seen as property. And whenever you have property, that becomes a priority.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to ask you, how do we make this transformation possible in terms of lifting up people over property, or as I'm suspect, in terms of what you were saying, that certainly this government is hopeless in terms of transformation, because the way they lift up property over people.
And as much as I dislike the Republicans and have been a Democrat most of my life, I am now very much against the Democrats as well, although I will be voting for Biden just to get Trump out. But I also believe that they have been bought out for decades, and it's been obvious for decades. I'm an older person, so I see this, but it's because, once again, they've bought into their own protecting their own assets and their own longevity, instead of once again looking at, and it is not looking for their children's future, because if they were, they would see that this behavior is killing the future, not ensuring it. So they're protecting their own assets, their own comfort, their own comfort zones. Everyone is in their comfort zones, that is, you know, these higher positions, and they don't want to risk getting out of them. They are so afraid of it. They're afraid of change that might disrupt those comfort zones in any way, shape, or form.
Well, you know, it occurred to me, you just mentioned, you know, just wanted to protect their own and their own comfort zone. And it's, you know, it occurred to me, it's not even caring for your children, because, I mean, you haven't even touched upon climate change and the inaction around that.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for making me further depressed.
I'm sorry. You know, there's a wonderful line. I've been reading Thomas Piketty's Capital and Ideology, and my 17-year-old has been accusing me of being so pessimistic, and yet I read this line in his book,
And it's in the introduction section. I can't remember what page or anything, but basically he said the thing that gives you hope is that change, the thing that all capitalists and all hyper-capitalists basically fear, is the inevitability of change. And with change, even though it may come abruptly or slowly or whatever, it comes. So whether they want to acknowledge it or not, their fight is futile. It's yes. just a question of, have we run out of time environmentally? That is yes. a sad question. Hopefully not. Hopefully we can take control and get that under control, because without that, the rest is mute. It's a moot point. It doesn't matter. But, yes, yeah. I think change is inevitable for the better. It's just a question of what price do we pay to get it? And
yeah.
whatever we have to pay, we have to pay, because this is not acceptable.
Right, right. Well, thank yeah. you. I jokingly said, for thank you know, you made me more depressed. And what I wanted to get to this today was to talk about what gives us hope. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's so important.
All right. We also have Ross on the line.
Okay. Well, good morning, Ross. How are you?
Good morning, Cesar. I'm well. It's a beautiful sunny morning. I hope it doesn't get too hot.
Stay cool.
Of course, that probably means it will be warm, and it will be warm on the streets tonight. And I'm so concerned because I think we're in the middle of a whole lot of confusion. And we've already covered a whole bunch of interesting things this morning with Democracy Now! And of course, your observations and the others who offered. I'm troubled by we have a certain romanticization of the past. And one of the romanticizations is romanticizing the Black Panthers, romanticizing the Malcolm X. One of the things that's romanticized is to cast them as violent and and maybe even indisciplined. And I don't think that Black Panthers stood up for self-defense. They didn't. I don't remember them throwing any Molotov cocktails or water bottles, and so I don't think it's quite right to imagine that Malcolm would come back and go down and help throw water bottles and stuff downtown. So I think we're off track, and I'm a little afraid that one of the generational differences that's happening today is that you know, demonstrations have happened spontaneously against this outpouring of just awful, awful ugliness, but it's in the middle of a country that's made an awful lot of progress. And when we respond to these things and we bring this out in such spontaneity, we didn't organize a nonviolent discipline. We didn't have our classes in reading Thoreau before we walked in the streets. But I think maybe we need to return to that, because the discipline of nonviolence was terribly important in the struggles of the 60s, and it's terribly important now. But this is not, we are not following a discipline of nonviolence, because a discipline of nonviolence does not say you walk down the street, and some of us follow one method of throwing rocks and writing "kill the cops" on the walls, and the other people carry their crosses. It just doesn't work that way.
Hey, Ross, I think that those are excellent points. And as you began, you said, you know, we have a tendency to romanticize the past, and you mentioned the Black Panthers. And I think what you shared was we have not a proper understanding of them. And I also think that's the case around nonviolence. And it's not a romanticization of nonviolence, but a misunderstanding of it. Could you say something more about the discipline of nonviolence and what that means?
Well, I'll give an example. There was a great, well, first begin with the March on Washington. We talk about it was so important to that march be conducted in under a discipline of nonviolence, and that was accomplished. Can you imagine what might have happened if, in fact, the greatest fears had turned the other way and it had been a mess of broken bottles in the streets? It would every demonstration is a presentation, is an act, is a performance, but it has an objective of winning hearts and minds. And so when you casually use methods that don't carry dignity and respect for nonviolence, you make yourself vulnerable to the enemies that want to stigmatize you as crazy extremists and so forth. And so that it's important that you have a central strategy of nonviolence. Now, I can remember back in the day, because my first experience was in 1963, and even goes back to in Mississippi. When Martin Luther King was killed, I was in Pittsburgh. This will be a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Pittsburgh did not break out in riots, but what did happen in the morning of April, what was it, 6 or 7? 68. The Friends of SNCC, which is a group I was involved with, and some SDS people, we got in touch with the United Negro Protest Committee, leaders of Downs and the NAACP, and together we immediately planned a nonviolent march that would go from the University of Pittsburgh and all the way down to Forbes Avenue to gather at the Federal Building and have an all-day vigil circulating. And that was an activity, but it had part of a purpose of preventing spontaneous outpouring of violent anger. Nonviolence it serves to keep the message on message and not get diverted into violence. And so I think that the same thing is true now. We have expressed great anger and outrage, and now it's time to do to get to the work of designing the changes that we want in our city and in our nation. And and maybe we need to get a little more imagination, because we're failing to use the energy and creativity of nonviolent discipline to have more effective demonstration, more effective activities.
Hold on, because I think that's a very important point you just made, Ross. And I also want to acknowledge that there is some creative nonviolent actions that's happening downtown that doesn't get the press that we see. So how people are caring for one another, how people are taking care of one another, making sure that people are healthy, that they are protected. We don't see that, but certainly on the news. But as people who are down there, there's some wonderful ways in which there are disciplined ways in which people are living that. And as you know, and I'm glad you shared your lived experience, it takes a lot of people, and things, social change is messy. But at the same time, I think, as you suggested, that we must stay on message. So that's really appreciated. And thank you for sharing your wisdom today.
We do our best, but I think that we haven't needed to have the discipline of nonviolence in so many cases. We haven't had but recently, and I'm really start by about 2006 or so, we've started to have organized groups whose purpose is to be menacing and basically violent, either by their...
Well, I think that's a good observation, but again, I'll go back. That there's also amazing things that are being done by groups currently in terms of living into into that nonviolent discipline, and it is occurring. We need to do more of that, but I don't want to say that's not happening now, or to say that that is not occurring in the mass demonstration or the way, the many different ways people are organizing in small groups. I think that people, many people are, many groups are following that strategy, and we'll see what happens. But we need to continue, as you suggest, Ross, to lift that up as something that we should promote.
We also
you
have,
are listening.
Oh, we also have Robbie on the line.
Okay, well, let's go to Robbie. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to, that was great. I'm enjoying the topic. I've been down at the Justice Center and also at random events throughout the city put on by different groups, either Rose City Justice or there hasn't been too much by Don't Shoot. Don't Shoot actually is now running the Portland Moms, Momtifa, as I like to call them.
Momtifa, I wanted love it.
Yeah, Momtifa, Dangerous Momtifa. yeah, great. I wanted to just say there is a lot of creativity going on down there. It sounded like the last caller, you know, and I loved what they had to say. But yeah, when you go down there, it's not really what, you know, the news recites, you know, after the fact. It is a lot different down there. There's drum lines being, you know, all sorts of stuff, as you know. I wanted to bring up that, but I also wanted to say the situation, as you know, it's messy when these things happen. And Martin Luther King had actually described, as a great interview, he describes that these marches, these rallies that he was doing, are cries for help. He says that a protest is a cry for help. And I think a lot of people, you know, and there is direct action events that happen that can do a direct goal, you know, like Occupy ICE. We shut down that facility for over 14 days, you know, and really did it. That was a direct action that did its goal. But furthermore, like this, you know, Martin Luther King said they're a cry for help. And so a lot of people expect protests and rallies to like fix everything. I feel, you know, it's like there's like this outside perspective, like they're a judge at a diving competition, and then they're going to critique, oh, this is a good protester, this is a good protester, this is a bad protester. And it gets into a slippery slope. It just gets into a slippery slope, because right now, and I'm sure it's being talked about in the news, it's the move since the beginning, since the very first week of this uprising, the Portland police have been trying to put in infiltrators. And what they're doing is they're getting organizers who are working with the police, and basically what they're doing is they're doing what the police are trying to co-opt the movement and then get us to go to where they want us to go. And so it's a really interesting scenario, because when this is playing out, it's like, and we go back to this, okay, so now we're at this rally, we're doing this stuff, but now the organizers are working with the police, and now we're going down this one road where the police want us to be. And then they're just going to let us, you know, chant down the street. And it's not causing the same pressure on the system that we do with the autonomous planning, which is, you know, we're going to be going to the North Precinct, we're going to be at the Justice Center at the same time, and creating that diversity of tactics, which is what the word is, and what people bring to these events, which is the spontaneousness, which is ultimately allowing us to have that upper hand over the police. So I just want to say, you know, these protests, they get messy, but at the end of the day, all these people who talk about the violence, I see property destruction. The violence is what we're protesting. So those are just my perspective on it.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much for that, and for your perspective on what's happening. I think it's so helpful to remember, as you the caller suggested, in terms of variety of tactics, and also the observation about, and this isn't anything new. In every movement, we see attempts to co-opt the movement. We've seen infiltrators. We've seen those who wish to misdirect the movement. This is nothing new. It has happened since time began. Every movement for change, we have those options. But we also see, and we must maintain the message that there are a variety of people and variety of tactics. One thing I think we should do, and we should remember, certainly in this moment of Black Lives Matters, that is uppermost, and not be distracted by that. And I think many people, all of those who are involved in this manifestation of the uprising, want to be clear. There might be a variety of tactics, but we all want to affirm is that Black Lives Matters. And when we lose that central emphasis, then we become open to all sorts of things. So as long as we remain focused, then we can do what Chairman Mao said, let a thousand flower blooms, a hundred of schools of thoughts contend. And yes, we may not all agree on tactics or which road, which street to march down, but there are many different ways in which people are organizing and doing things. And I am not going to say that one way is the only way. And again, if you are a student of history, you realize that that occurs in many movements. We need many people with many perspectives and believe in the strength and the power of people power to make changes. So in these days, let us remember to continue to be persistent. And in this week, when we remember, and as John Lewis is memorialized in different places, it's an opportunity to look at just one person in one movement at one place in time and see the consistency of his hope, but also recognize the different ways in which he did his battle. From a young 19-year-old college student, where he first encountered methods of, as Ross said earlier, the discipline of nonviolence, to leadership in a student organization which included everyone from Stokely Carmichael to John Lewis, and having to struggle with the ideological struggle within an organization, to his battle in 1986 when he ran for Congress and was competed against his old friend from SCLC, and they both competed for the congressional seat, and they model, I think, a way in which to work for social change, and including through his career as a congressperson, how John Lewis consistently kept, and we say this over and over, his eye on the prize. So my fellow collaborators in social justice movement, let us keep our eyes on the prize. Let us continue to lift up one another, encourage one another, and not be discouraged or distracted by the maneuvers of those powers and those systems which seek to keep us down. That which we seek will happen, and let us be encouraged, for freedom is coming. You have been listening to More Talk Radio here on community radio station KBOO. I'm Cecil Prescott. I hope that you are safe. Be safe, stay healthy, wash your hands, wear your face mask as you protest, keep social distance, but remain united in our goals for transformation and a better world for all of us. Stay tuned for more insightful programming here on Community Radio Station KBOO. I want to encourage those of you who are able to share in KBOO by going to our website, kboo.fm, and if you're able to donate, it's a way in which you can be a part of the movement for social change. But until next week, I thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned. Be listening on Monday, July 27th at 8:58 a.m. Stay tuned for the OMO Variety Hour. Be listening at some other time. Just listen to, stay tuned and for something else. Thank you so much for being a part of our radio show this morning, program this morning. And now I'm going to turn it over to our very capable engineer as we move on.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.